From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. This morning we speak with journalist and retrologist Rolando Pujol, who celebrates the nostalgic pleasures of America's vintage signs, quirky roadside attractions, and offbeat fast food relics from coast to coast. In his new book, The Great American Retro Road Trip, it's a celebration of roadside Americana. Then award-winning journalist Susan Dominus joins us. She dives into the mystery of sibling success. It's all in her new book, The Family Dynamic. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. What is more nostalgic than the memory of an American road trip? The sense of freedom and exploration, adventure and an open road connection, and memories, simplicity and escape. My next guest, journalist Rolando Pujol, in his new book, The Great American Retro Road Trip, a celebration of roadside Americana, celebrates the nostalgic pleasures of America's vintage signs, quirky roadside attractions, and offbeat fast food relics. Remember those orange roofs of Howard Johnson's, all of the shiny diners that we've seen across the country, and those beyond life-size green and yellow muffler men? Well, it's all in his new book. Rolando, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much. It's great to be part of The Mountain Life.
It's great to have you. It's always so difficult when a large part of this story you're presenting has to do with something that I can see, but our listeners can't see. So we're going to have to bring it to life for them. What better way than to start with something in Utah we have all seen many times out in the Salt Flats, heading out I-80 towards Wendover, is the Utah Tree of Life, or the Tree of Utah Tree of Life. It's a metaphor, and you include that in your book.
So that I photographed the Tree of Life back in 2014 on a cross-country trip that I was taking along the Lincoln Highway, which goes through the state. And the minute I saw it, it actually wasn't on my dance card, if you will. I wasn't expecting it. And then I see this sculpture out there in the flats. You know, they look like these gigantic orbs or tennis balls or whatever it is. Like, what is going on here? So we pulled over with my friends and we grabbed a few photos of it. And when you find out the story of it, it really is so fascinating. There's so many aspects of it that are unique. It's first of all, it's such a big thing, and so much creativity went into it. Everything from, you know, 225 tons of cement, thousands of ceramic tiles, all the welding rod, minerals and rocks that are native to the state, to Utah. As I wrote in the book, at first glance, it almost looks like a collection of concrete tennis balls or giant lollipops. But the magic of the Tree of Life is its abstraction. And a plaque in the sculpture quotes, "Ode to joy, apt words for the feelings that the sculpture has the power to generate." I mean, next time I'm out there, I almost want to play "Ode to joy." I didn't quite do that because that would really get you into the mindset. But I think that word, joy, I think is very, very powerful insofar as these road trips are concerned, because that's part of what I'm looking for here. I'm looking for joyful, beautiful experiences that connect us to our fellow Americans, that give you a sense of place for other places that you're not familiar with. I think that's the wonder of travel. You come back with memories and photos of quirky sites like the Tree of Life, but you also come back with a feeling for what it is to be in that part of Utah. And what were the people like? What was that experience like? That's the stuff I feel that stays with you more than the photos or the, you know, what you put up on Instagram about your trip.
Well, it's so funny because while looking at your book and reading through it and trying to experience it along with you, it really conjures memories of our own. neon signs that we've seen, that we've sort of marveled at and wonder how they still exist and are maintained, and, you know, roadside attractions that are just so bizarre. And the thing that you do that I think is so wonderful, I mean, you talk about how you were a fan of these things from a little boy looking out the backseat of your parents' station wagon when you traveled. Talk about that fascination.
Absolutely. To me, a lot of it goes back to both the travels that I did around home. I grew up in North Tarrytown, New York, which is north of New York City. It's now known as Sleepy Hollow, so as in the Headless Horseman. So it was a place that was already suffused with history. So I think that helped shape my interest. But then also all around, there were interesting roadside attractions like Muffler Men and Holiday Inn signs. And those made a real impact on an impressionable child. But I think I can almost trace the beginning of all of this to a road trip that we took in July of 1977 along I-95. In I-95, you might think, well, there's not a lot of interesting things to see along I-95. The Eisenhower interstate system took away so much of the charm of the country. And yes, it did to some extent. It certainly made it easier to get around. But a curious culture built around the interstate as well, that's fascinating. And so as a four-year-old visiting south of the border in Dillon, South Carolina, was a fascinating, overwhelming, visually stimulating place. This sort of ersatz, sort of Mexican wonderland, nowhere near Mexico, and certainly perhaps not culturally, appropriate. But there's a certain charm and curiosity to the place that certainly to the eyes of a child is very impactful. And as you continued on that trip down to Florida and all those roadside attractions and places built around orange groves and live gators and places like this, culminating in Miami Beach and both the mid-century and the old Art Deco places down in South Beach, which in the 70s and 80s were not what they are today. It was a very different place. But this made a very, very potent sort of impression on me. And it wasn't really until 20 or so years later as an adult when I began to take my own road trips that my journey of discovery really reached the next level. And I decided, I'm not simply fascinated in this stuff. I want to sort of document it and share it with a wider audience.
Yes. Wow. You talk about in your book, The Great American Retro Road Trip, the sense of innovation and creativity that you believe really represented what America was at the time that a lot of these were being erected, produced, and now revered. What do you think it was that made us come up with these, just amazing signs and attractions to lure people in?
Yeah, it's architecture built not just for people, of course, but really more for the car. It was all about the growth of easier and much less expensive travel, where families could actually, pile into their own car and get out there and explore the country. It's no surprise that so much of this begins in the 1920s and in a very determined way. That's when Route 66 opens, the Path of Lincoln Highway. More roads are being blazed and paved, and more of the country is now accessible to more and more people. And so if you're a proprietor of a roadside business, you're going to try to do something to make sure that those Model Ts that are chugging by are going to stop at your business, not the business down the road. So you're going to try to create some kind of attraction that captures the attention, whimsy, and gives you something to photograph and to enjoy, but also ideally spend some money. And so some of the great examples of mimetic or form follows function architecture can be traced to the 20s and 30s. And the book is teeming with a number of them, including places like the giant coffee pot along the Lincoln Highway in Bedford, Pennsylvania, the Big Duck, which is out in Flanders, New York, on the eastern part of Long Island. These roadside giants that were just so compelling. You see them even today, and they make you stop and do a double take. which to me gives you some insight into the fact that there's still a lot of appeal in this. It may feel dated and homey and a throwback to a more innocent time, but the fact of the matter is, I'm a big believer that people and what attracts people to things doesn't really change very much from generation to generation. So I think that if you build a place like this today, they will come, they will appreciate it. It's not all about social media and online marketing and push notifications based on GPS. It's also based on creating a sense of excitement and a sense of experience. And I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of stopping at a Buc-ee's, one of those roadside convenience stores. They started in Texas and they've been spreading around the country, but they use a lot of the same old school marketing techniques that you used to see and that are still deployed by places like South Border or Wall Drug in South Dakota. So billboards that create a sense of excitement as you approach, and then, you know, quirky, interesting things to see and do once you finally arrive. Some sort of promise about if you just wait another 74 miles, something very special awaits you. And Buc-ee's is doing a great job of doing that today, a relatively new company that, if you told me, had been around since the 1930s, I would believe you.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. It's funny when you mentioned the Walls Drug in South Dakota. Yeah. I knew about the Walls Drug in South Dakota long before I had ever even been to South Dakota. And then one time I did see it when I came to South Dakota, and I couldn't believe that it was, you know, like, why do I know about this? Why do a lot of people? And so there must be something about the reverence, the, you know, preservation, the way we honor these things. What in particular, why did I know about the Walls Drug sign before I ever thought of going to South Dakota?
It's one of those things that just seeps into the broader American culture and creates an internal dialogue in your mind about it. Like, what is this place? Why do so many people care about it? Like, I have a sticker. I'm not going to turn my computer around, but if I could, I would show you. It's where the heck is Wall Drug? Those bumper stickers that you'll
see. Yeah.
It's the bumper sticker that you saw subconsciously over the course of many years, and then finally you saw, hey, I'm near that Wall Drug place, you know, let's stop. And of course, the promise of the Wall Drug experience that you're going to get a free cup of ice water, right? Which is not a particularly extraordinary thing to, I mean, you have your tumbler right now that you're drinking from, you know, this is not a great inducement to pull over, ice water, right? But yet, I never wanted ice water more that when I see, and I get there and I have it and it's very nice, and then you're there and then you poke around a little bit and you just enjoy the kitsch, the audacity, the creativity, and all the interesting things that form around this place. The Wall Drug now is home. Adjacent to Wall Drug, a couple of blocks away, is a gigantic jackalope building that you can now go inside, and, you know, there's a little jackalope observation deck where you can take in the Badlands, right? So these very interesting ancillary places develop around these attractions. You can go down a rabbit hole or a jackalope hole, I guess, or whatever, very, very quickly. So I think there's something about this kind of marketing that just is very natural to the way we think and we see the world that I think will have appeal 100 years from now. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, because I wanted to get these places preserved in a physical book. Because we know how ephemeral digital technology is. Facebook's around now. Instagram's around now. But will it be in 10 or 15 years? I hope so, for all the people who work there, right? But it may not be, right? But a book is forever. And to the extent that you can get these places down in one place that will survive all of us, the better.
Yes. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Rolando Pujol. He's a journalist, and he's written a book called The Great American Retro Road Trip. He also calls himself, and I have to ask about this, Rolando, you call yourself a retrologist. I love that word. Is that a real word? Did you marry this?
I made it a neologism. I just sort of made it up in 2012 after I came up with it. I Googled it, and somebody else was using it as well, but it wasn't exactly a word that was, chiseled in stone somewhere. People don't, so I figured, hey, this kind of works for what I do. And so what is a metrologist? It's sort of like an expert, a doctor, an unofficial doctor in studying nostalgia, retro places, vintage places, right? That to me spoke to it, because what I do is not just simply go to a place and take a picture and move on. Isn't that pretty? I try to go in and tell the story and do the research, but I also keep an eye for little things that might be easy to overlook. For example, I have a little section in the book called The Pullovers, which are sprinkled all throughout the book with this little gems of things that may not be that probably would have ended up on the editing room floor, but they were so interesting that I wanted to put them in. And a nice, metrologist find is running into an old payphone that still said U.S. West on it and had the old Bell logo. And what's that about? How did that survive all these years? I think most people under the age of 30 don't know what U.S. West is or what a local Bell company was. But this gives you a little opportunity to tell that story in 100 words and then whet people's appetite and develop put on their retrologist spectacles, if you will, and start to look at the built environment, looking for these little, what is this? Why is that still there? Why should I care about what Mountain Bell used to be or whatever? So,
yeah. It makes me wonder about how we view the world, and do we really celebrate this nostalgia? And if so, I feel like just reading your book and looking through your amazing photos, it makes me want to celebrate nostalgia. Whereas before, previously, I admit I am that person who gets in the car, and if I have a 9-hour drive, there is no stopping. I am just going. It's podcasts all the way. I'm trying not to stop. It really wakes up this thing that I think is important that maybe we've lost. So who are the people that maintain that?
Right. Oh, that's such a good question. And it's funny. I've taken road trips with friends who more share your outlook of things. They look at travel as an efficient thing, rather than the journey being the actual destination, if you will. But I think all of us inside have the potential to be this kind of more quirky, a little bit more, adaptable kind of travel, where you're stopping more, you're asking questions, and you're taking the exit. Because to me, there's nothing more exciting than, let's say because I do research for tremendous research before I ever hit the road, and I have Google Maps for every state with a little. They look like somebody with chickenpox with all these little places they have to visit or have visited. But when I'm passing on I-90, and I pass a little town, historic downtown, and I've got nothing there, and I don't know about this place, I mean, I've got to pull over and see what could possibly be here. And I have almost always been rewarded by indulging that curiosity. But I think to enjoy this, you really have to sculpt the plan around the idea, the trip around the idea that you're going to be doing this kind of travel. Maybe there is a quote unquote, to use National Lampoon's Vacation, there is a Wally World there is a place you're going to in the end that you're hoping to get to, and hopefully it won't be closed, But if you just time it just so, you can stop at a lot of more places. And chances are, when you look back on the trip, it'll be all the little diversions and getting lost trying to find this roadside giant. And I could swear the GPS said it was here, but it wasn't there. But then we found that other place and we had lunch there. Remember that woman who, all those little stories build up, and then you have had, I think, a much, much richer vacation or even quick weekend trip, because you can do this even in your home city. You can start to look at places that you take for granted in a different light, and maybe go to an adjacent town you've never visited where there's a cafe that might be of note. And find something else while you're there, a little bookstore or something. This is sort of endless, the things that you can begin to experience when you put on those, retrologist spectacles.
Oh, absolutely. And since you mentioned what we can look at and gain an appreciation for that we might not have thought about before. I better talk about here in the Wasatch Back in Heber City, just down the road from where I am, the Sinclair Oil dinosaur Octane.
Octane. Oh, my God. Isn't he cute? You know, and you know, it's funny. This one, I found out about Octane from one of my editors at Artisan Books. She'd grown up in the area, and we were talking about my stops in Utah, and she said, well, have you been to Heber City, and do you know about Octane? And I'm like, I don't, do tell. And then to find out that Octane is this wonderful fiberglass Sinclair dinosaur that sits out there outside of this gas station in town, and that he gets routinely dressed up in different outfits to reflect different themes or anniversaries or things that are going on. What an absolutely wonderful little story. And then I visited Octane, but then I found as I traveled the country in doing research for this book, there were other Sinclair stations as well where people saw the creative possibilities of the dinosaur. He wasn't just, you know, they weren't just there to sit and look pretty. They were there to be dressed and to have a little fun with it. But I love that kind of stuff because it gives you this insight, you know, into a sense of place, into the people who operate this place, and into the wider community. You know, it's a nice town when people sort of adopt a fiberglass dinosaur as one of their own, right? I mean, that makes it very, really special.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so fun to talk about these things because just knowing how much you appreciate them, it is quite contagious, I would say. And, you know, I just noticed, because I looked through you break up the book into sections of the country. And so, of course, I looked through the West and the Cowboy Bar neon sign on the square in Jackson, Wyoming, and the Antler Motel neon sign. I've seen those, you know, my whole life.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful signs. And yet I never quite thought about them in the way that you bring to light in the book, which is so delightful, I have to say.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. To hear that, I'm going to take that clip of you saying this and like put it on my book page, because that's exactly what I'm hoping to do with this book, is to not only introduce you to places, but also help you appreciate places that you already know and love, or maybe just take for granted. You know, the Cowboy Bar with the big bucking cowboys is always there. It's just like this thing that's just there whenever I'm in town, you know, going off to Yellowstone. But now you look at it in a different light. You know a little bit of the backstory. Maybe you'll go inside if you've never gone inside before, make a new friend. So it just adds richness to your experiences.
Absolutely. So I'm wondering, you know, you've talked about the Lincoln Highway. You've talked about Route 66, which really gained a lot of fame and maybe started this retrologist movement of people appreciating the retro. And then, you know, you include a sign about the loneliest highway in the world that is Highway 50 that runs through Utah into Nevada.
Yep.
And I've only been on sections of that, and I'm wondering if they have at all, you know, sort of capitalized on this fame of being the loneliest highway in the world by doing interesting things that might attract people.
But they absolutely have. When I did the trip through the loneliest highway back in 2014, I participated in, they had, and perhaps still do, I'll have to double check that, a passport program where you would stop in different places and mark that I was there. And once you had put together enough places in your little passport book, you would send it off to the Tourism Bureau, and they would send you back an official document saying that you had survived the loneliest highway. You know, what a wonderful thing. And I have that framed somewhere in my apartment. It's just a great little souvenir. So they had them playing with that, because what that whole moniker of loneliest highway, it was initially meant as a kind of almost a put down by the writer who did the original piece about that, using that back in the mid 80s. But people in the area, the towns in Austin, all these little Eli and all these places along the road, took that as a, no, this is actually a good thing. We are proud to be the loneliest highway in America, and we want you to come and visit it and find out that it's not so lonely, and it's not so scary, and there's a lot of wonderful things to see. Like, one of the great highlights of my road tripping, the McGill Drugstore, which is an extraordinary place to visit, a drugstore that's frozen in time, that shut down in 1979 and has not been touched since, which is incredible.
Well, the book is The Great American Retro Road Trip. My guest is journalist Rolando Pujol. And what a delight it has been to speak with you today. Thank you for waking us up to this thing.
Lynn, I really appreciate you saying that. And thanks for the opportunity to talk with you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Olympic athlete, an award-winning novelist, a successful entrepreneur, all raised under one roof. What can we learn from those families whose children aim high and succeed, sometimes in widely varied fields? Just as important, what were those costs along the way? My next guest, Susan Dominus, has worked for The New York Times since 2007. First as a Metro columnist and then as a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. And in 2018, she was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize for public service for its reporting on workplace sexual harassment. Susan joins me now to delve into a journey into the mystery of sibling success. Her new book is called The Family Dynamic. Susan, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's such a pleasure to have you. This book has been really meticulously researched by you, and yet it kicks off with a conversation that you had with your older brother when you were in high school.
Yeah. So when I was a freshman in high school, I was, you know, a kid who ran track and I played piano, diffidently at best, I would say. And my brother came home from college one day, he's 6 years older, and said, you know, Susie, I think you should think about joining the high school newspaper. And I said, well, I would, but it's been disbanded. So, you know, I went back to reading whatever I was reading. And my brother then stood in the doorway and basically harangued me until I finally agreed to restart the high school newspaper. And what's funny about that is that as soon as I started working on it and the first story started trickling in, I realized immediately that there was nowhere else I wanted to be. This is what I was meant to do, or that I wanted to do. And, you know, I've always thought about it because for two reasons. One is my brother really knew me and he really got me. And he also understood, you know, high school culture and what a high school should look like, since he had just left one. Which is something that wasn't necessarily true of my parents, obviously. And also that if my parents had been the ones to suggest that, I don't think I would have, you know, what do adolescents do when parents make suggestions? They generally roll their eyes. So, and I was a big eye roller. So I think there's something really powerful about advice that comes from siblings, especially during adolescence, when parents tend to feel that their kids don't trust them quite the same way.
Yeah. And so this might sort of lead us into the influence that our brothers and sisters have on us. I think of my husband is the youngest of seven, and he oftentimes talks about how he didn't get raised by his parents. He mostly got raised by his siblings. And thankfully, all of his siblings are these just wonderful people that had the most wonderful influence on him. Really interesting that maybe our siblings know us better than our parents in some ways, especially during that adolescence, as you talk about. What did you find in your research about that kind of influence on us? And what sets the stage for having your siblings be more influential on you than your parents?
from whom do young people want to get perspectives and advice? They want advice from people who understand them and who understand their circumstances. And increasingly, as we discussed, like in adolescence, those are your peers. It might be your friends, but it might also be your siblings because they are from your environment. You know, they understand your environment. They also see who you are a little bit more. But your siblings see you operate in social settings where there are no adults around. They see your strengths. They see your weaknesses, reading each other sometimes. And so they also understand generational, because the Holifield family, they're a group of civil rights activists from Tallahassee, Florida. And when Marilyn Holifield was graduating from college in 1968, her brother said to her, "I think you should go to Harvard Law School." There were so few Black women who were going to Harvard Law School at the time. But for her brother, who was part of a new generation, a new world, that was a very obvious path for her to take. And he really urged, he sort of bullied her into going to law school the way my brother bullied me into starting a newspaper. And it was hugely consequential for her life. And he really saw her strengths and why he thought she would be a good lawyer. And indeed, she went on to become the first Black female law partner at a major firm in Florida, and then went on to use that power for all sorts of other civil rights activity.
That's a wonderful story. And, you know, how does birth order play into all of this? Because, you know, there are just those classic signs of the oldest, the middle child, the youngest child. How does that spin into this story?
So birth order is really complicated. I think it's very appealing to people as a way to explain their entire family and also who they are out in the world. But like nothing is really that simple. You know, we're all creatures of our environment, but you know, our environment extends far beyond our family. And the thinking has always been that the oldest child is the most conscientious and that the youngest is a little bit more of a rebel. But there's been really good personality research in recent years. And what it finds is that when families and siblings rate their oldest child as the most conscientious, they're kind of not taking into effect the fact that the oldest child is also the oldest. And so they might developmentally be farther along and seem like they're the most conscientious. But when the other siblings get to be that age, they themselves might be just as conscientious or more so. So when the studies are conducted in ways that control for those kinds of phenomena, they find that birth order does not have an effect on personality. The only birth order effect that seems to be consistent, and this is consistent in families for whom English is the first, you know, for whom the language of the country they live in is their native language, but usually the first child does have a cognitive edge. They're the most academic. They get the highest grades. They score the highest on like cognitive tests. And the thinking for that is that the oldest child is the only child in a family who is ever an only child. And so as an only child, they were the beneficiaries of all of this enrichment and attention from their parents in those crucial early developmental years or months even. I mean, it could be a matter of 18 months and you see how powerful that is. Older siblings, also the gap really is, you know, you start to really see the academic gap in which older kids pull away even a little bit more as they get older. And the thinking it's because they actually teach their younger siblings and that there's something that consolidates information and thinking skills when you're doing teaching. So then a lot follows from there. You know, if the oldest child is the most academic, maybe they seem the most successful, maybe they set a standard. And then younger siblings sometimes, we think, differentiate in interesting ways so that you have In the family, the Groff family that you started the segment talking about, there's an Olympic athlete, there's an award-winning novelist. Sarah True, who is this world champion Ironman competitor and Olympic triathlete, basically told me that she pursued sports because she felt like she could never equal her siblings in academics, her two older siblings. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but she certainly perceived it to be true. And there has been research that shows that younger siblings are overrepresented in varsity sports and even in elite sports. So, and that younger siblings even fare better sometimes when they're both competing sometimes you see two siblings competing at a very high level in elite sports, and that the younger sibling often seems to surpass the older as well.
Hmm. Well, in your research then, did you find that it's pretty rare to have a family in which all of the siblings are successful and high achieving? How rare is it?
I would say that I was looking for families in which there were multiple high achieving siblings. Like, in other words, enough that you'd be like, wow, what was going on in that family? But it's almost unheard of for every single sibling in the family to be high achieving. Like, when you think about some of the most famous families, such as the Emanuel brothers, Rahm Emanuel, who is just ambassador to Japan and very close advisor to Obama, mayor of Chicago, his brother Ezekiel Emanuel, famous bioethicist, his other brother Ari Emanuel, the most powerful man in Hollywood, arguably, you know, they have an adopted sister who they rarely speak about just to protect her privacy, but she has a very typical life and has even had, you know, some real struggles. So even the families that we think of as most emblematic, there's, you know, it's very rare. So much has to happen in someone's life for them to reach a very high level of success. It always involves some luck, you know, even if it's just luck of the genes. And so for all four children in one family to have good, you know, the good fortune not to get mono their senior year of college, you know, so that it affects their law school applications, whatever it is, you know, and it's very unusual. But I was focusing, I mean, the Groff family is that family. They're all three incredibly high achieving. But I would say there is definitely variations in the families that I wrote about. But I was looking for multiples.
Yeah. So going back to the Groff family, for example, did you find something in the parenting that you felt determined it maybe more so than other factors like the influence that your siblings have on you?
So the one factor that I saw across the board, and, you know, in a way is almost not that helpful for parents because you can't necessarily gin this up in your own life. But a lot of these parents were incredible overcomers themselves. They had done something extraordinary that was kind of quiet and personal. You know, Jeanine Groff, their mother, had come from a very hard Scrabble background. Her father was a drinker who could sometimes be very, very violent. And she had gotten herself to, you know, Franklin and Marshall and was a star baton twirler and choreographer of like major football game, marching band, you know, cheerleading shows at a very young age. She was actually thinking about going to medical school at a time when very few women were doing that. Their father had been from a family that was so poor that he was actually put in basically an orphanage for some portion of his life and had gotten to Franklin Marshall, I think, on a sports scholarship and become this very successful doctor. So they saw parents who worked incredibly hard to create a beautiful life for them. And I think there was also just this energy, you know, what kind of people overcome those kinds of hardship? Incredibly energetic people. So I think they saw this just burning energy. Their parents were never sitting still. It wasn't the kind of house their friends said where you could just sit around and watch TV. The expectations were very, very high.
As parents, you never know how much to push your kids or how much to allow them to develop naturally. And it depends on the child. You know, I was around a friend of mine and her son recently, and she kept talking to me in front of him about how he's a bad test taker. Is that programming him into thinking he's a bad test taker? But on the other hand, he's a very competitive person and a very competent person. And I thought maybe in his case, it's going to be more about him proving his mother wrong and becoming a good test taker. I don't know. I mean, did you find in all of this research that the questions and the answer to those questions are just tossed in the air?
You know, it's funny because I feel like as a mother of fraternal twins who has faced many a parenting quandary, I have so much empathy for everyone else's parenting choices. And I can imagine that that mom was the narrative in that family, I bet, is that you're super bright. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. It's just you don't take these stupid tests very well. You know what I mean? So you're right. It could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. But I bet in that family, the narrative is don't let your SAT score, you know, make you feel you're not brilliant because I'm telling you, you are, you know? The answer is that first of all, I love that you said it depends on the child because I always joke, you know, that parenting advice should come with a warning. Don't try this at home because your own child, you know, these, whatever parenting research there is, and a lot of it's not very well conducted, frankly, your kid could be the outlier for whom that advice does not really apply. So you have the most important advice that parents have to keep in mind is know your own child and know your child's limits. And what you don't want to do is set expectations so high that they're not reachable for your particular child. I mean, I spoke to one mom who said, I don't understand. I set the expectations the same for both of my children and one met them seamlessly and the other one just struggled. And I just wanted to say to her, you know, children do have different talents and capabilities. There really are sometimes limits. And if you set the expectations too high, we know that that leads to stress and to anxiety. And so with expectations in particular, as my friend Jenny Anderson, who's a wonderful writer, said, it's maddeningly nuanced, the research on expectations. Like, yes, you want to set expectations high, and we know that those do have an effect on how kids perform. But parents also are, you know, generally in a healthy situation, they're basing those expectations on feedback that they're getting from those kids about what they're capable of. And if you decide arbitrarily what you want those expectations to be, that can actually be not just bad for your kids' mental health, but counterproductive and hurt their academic performance.
Yes. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with an award-winning New York Times journalist, Susan Dominus, and she joins to talk about her new book, The Family Dynamic. So, Susan, because you are the mother of fraternal twins, and no doubt you looked all into the vast amount of studies on twins, both fraternal and identical, how did it change your parenting, if at all?
You know, it's funny. If I'm totally honest, what I think about the most is a moment that Marilyn Hollifield shared with me about her piano playing when she was younger. And it was this one of her fondest memories. I could tell just from the way she recalled it of her mother was that her mother would come into the living room and sit and just enjoy her daughter's playing. And, you know, a little chill went down my spine, I think, because my son really enjoys playing piano and I'm a little bit musical. And, you know, sometimes I feel like it wouldn't hurt to point out, I think you might want to slow it down there, or you might, I feel like your, you know, your rhythm is a little bit off. And what I realized was that what would be best for not just Leo's playing probably and his feeling of ownership over that, but also our relationship, would be for me just to sit and enjoy and never give any feedback other than to say, thank you, I enjoyed that, because it's his, you know, his piano playing is his, he owns it. And it's not something that we beat him into submission into doing. It's something he came to on his own eventually. And the benefits of us feeling good about all of that and our relationship are so much stronger than whatever incremental improvement he might or might not get from his playing if every time he sat down, he braced himself for some feedback from me. So it's this very classic stuff. Like, I think parents, even on the soccer field, you know, I'm a big believer in let the coach coach. Let your home environment be a safe place. Like, let the teacher teach. If your kid's totally falling apart, obviously you need to get involved. But I do think that outsourcing a lot of the things that parents think is their job to do can make for a healthier relationship at home.
Exactly. That, you know, what we were talking about, the firstborn, the oldest sibling, and the amount of time that we have to parent them before the next sibling comes along, oftentimes determines, you know, some of the outcomes. But I did want to ask you about this overparenting sort of thing. You know, maybe some of those kids are overparented while the next sibling that comes along, it's kind of a mishmash of, oh, figure it out. We're busy parents. Yeah, what did you think about that? Because that also is about, you know, it lines up with what you're talking about with, you know, provide love, provide safety, provide stability. But aside from that, you know, it's a crapshoot.
You know, it's really funny that you say that, because it turns out that research has shown that parents, not only do they give more enrichment to their first child in those, you know, first months, but they do enforce rules around, you know, things like television watching or video game playing, and also are more strict about like homework and things like that with their oldest child than their younger children. This economist, Joseph Hotz, has this very funny theory, which is that they basically spend all of that energy on the firstborn in the hopes that if they set that up right, then the expectations will trickle down to the younger children. And that with every passing child, you get less bang for your buck out of forcing them to, you know, pay attention to their academics. So you're right that the oldest child is the most overparented. It doesn't necessarily make them less academically successful, but it is a different experience for those kids for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also, if we decide about or if parents decide about their children that one is the more athletic or one is the more academic, what kind of ripple effects does that have?
Well, that's it, right? Labeling, you know, it's kind of inevitable, but parents aren't always right about it either. Like sometimes parents decide that a certain child is more academic than the other. Maybe, you know, often they overestimate how much the older child is academically superior simply because the older child is older. And so they seem so much, you know, more together. And when they do that, they really can, we do know that they can exacerbate the differences in those kids more than would ordinarily be the case. And, you know, it's hard to know because we don't actually, it's hard to know what the kids' talents really are, short of, you know, eventually genetic testing will make some of this more clear, and then we'll know how much parenting effects influence the way that we categorize kids and what that means for the ripple effects. But we do know that they get it wrong sometimes, and when they do, it can create false differences between the kids.
Mm. What I love about your book, The Family Dynamic, is the number of stories that you introduce and just looking, you know, having a little peek into other families and how they go through life and how they manage. And there are so many stories of immigrants coming into this country and the parents working so hard to open up like an ethnic restaurant, for example. And you talk about the Chen family. They're really interesting. They moved from China into Appalachia and opened a restaurant there. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked about the Chens. I'm so fond of all of these families. And I'm also glad the family dynamic really, in an ideal world, people almost have a novelistic experience when they're reading it. It's just these very intimate, messy, loving family stories. But they moved from China to the United States and opened a Chinese restaurant. And they were working so hard that that's one of the families in which you see the sibling effects be really strong because the parents just really weren't around very much. And also they didn't have a handle on how the schools worked. They didn't know what an AP class was or who the best music instructor was. You know, the oldest sibling there was actually 2 years older than her classmates because when she arrived in the United States, she didn't speak very much English. And so they wanted to give her plenty of time to catch up. But what that meant was that when she did catch up, she was much older than the other kids in her grade, which made it very easy for her to be a teacher's favorite, you know? And so she did very well in school. And then she really advised her younger siblings and they in turn advised each other. And in fact, there was a fourth sibling who was born in the United States. And the three oldest ones were already away, either at college or working by the time he was applying to college. And they really, as a team from around the country, were like his college advising team. And they, one helped with the essay, one helped with the application process, one helped with the SATs. And they formed a reading group to make sure that he was doing good reading, you know, reading good books. And so they really felt their sibling responsibility to be paramount.
Mm. You know, during this conversation, it's really come to light for me that as a parent, we could maybe have a lot of influence on how one sibling affects another. So my question is, as parents, how could we better teach our children how to have a good influence, a positive influence, you know, teach our kids to teach their siblings?
I wish I had better advice for you about that than I do. But I think just in general, when there's a healthy sibling relationship, that's more likely to happen. And so one of the things parents have to do, I think, is be real with themselves about favoritism, spend that extra time with whatever child they feel they're not favoring, because that can create real bitterness between siblings and rivalries. But also just not making those comparisons, you know, well, you're this and your brother is that. And, you know, you're the one who this and your brother's that. Or why can't you be more like? Those sorts of things, I think, really just set your kids up to see themselves as in competition rather than in collaboration.
Right. Well, we've run out of time here, but I have to ask you about the Bronte sisters, the incredible literary success. I've always wondered about them, and what was it in their family that created this? I mean, was it the parents? Was it sibling influence?
Oh, I'm so glad that you asked that question, because as is true for most of the families in the book, I would say it was both. They had a father, you know, people think of the Brontes as this consummately English family. What could be more English than, you know, tea and the Brontes? But their father was an Irish immigrant at a time when it was incredibly difficult for somebody of his station to rise in rank. And he actually was so bright and so talented that he came from real poverty, that he won a scholarship to Cambridge, where he excelled. So they had that inspiring, I call it the overcomer story. They had that in their father, who was, a local leader, in that he was a minister in their town, but he spoke out on all kinds of events about getting better water supply to the town. He was in favor of education. So he was a tremendously impressive man who overcame a lot. But the sibling effect was hugely powerful. I mean, they all wrote together and they were very competitive. They had a brother who was also a terrific writer who sadly succumbed to addiction. But if Charlotte hadn't come to Emily and said, listen, I just happened to read some of your poems. I think they're really good. And we should publish a book of poetry together. The Brontes could not have succeeded without each other, because they didn't each have enough work to get that first volume out into the world. But they had enough because there was Anne, there's a third sister, Anne Bronte. The three of them had enough poetry that they could publish a book And then when Charlotte Bronte had her great success with Jane Eyre, she wrote under a pseudonym. And all of a sudden, other publishers wanted other books from people with a similar pseudonym, which her sisters had. So their novels got published. So their story is completely, bound up with each other. And they were hugely influential creatively as well.
Well, what a great book you've written. I have gifted this to my mom. I don't think she's received it yet, but she happens to have four children who are all vastly different from each other. And I think she'll just get the biggest kick out of this. Of course, as we do throughout life, my mom's 86. She's probably still wondering where she went right and where she went wrong as a parent. It's the biggest, toughest job ever, isn't it?
It is. And the one thing I can say of that I hope people take away from the book is what parenting is, and this would be calming for people, is that parenting effects are much smaller than we think they are. Sibling effects are probably bigger than we think, but parents don't have as much power as they think they do. I mean, think about it. Your kid spends more time in school with their friends, on video games, watching TV. So much more of that is in their life than is really in interacting with you. And although your values are important to them, they're getting so much input. And so take some of the pressure off yourself. Focus on enjoying your relationship with your children and making them feel safe and loved, and putting opportunity in front of them, and then letting the world and letting them do the work.
The book is The Family Dynamic: is a Journey into the Mystery of Sibling Success. My guest is journalist Susan Dominus. Susan, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
It was one of my favorite interviews. Thank you so much, Lynn. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.